Welcome to the Entrepreneur's Logbook podcast, where we uncover the strategies and insights driving extraordinary business growth. My name is Zachary Bernard. I'm your host. And today I'm joined by Frank Zid, general partner at 20 Adventures. Frank has spent over the last two decades helping companies grow from early stage startup to successful exit, and has built an impressive track record of identifying and nurturing these high potential companies. Through 20 Adventures, he's developed a very comprehensive approach to supporting founders, connecting them with the right resources, while helping them shape their strategic vision. Frank, it's great to have you on the show.
Hey, thank you so much for the kind words and the kind intro. I'm very surprised myself when you say those things, because I don't really see it that way. You know, I've been just under 20 years in the industry. I guess it is going to be 20 years. Okay. I sometimes forget my age, but I still feel like I'm 22 years old, man.
Fair enough. I think probably like the best place like start this would be to perhaps get like a bit of background around like your, obviously like your expertise. You've obviously started into like the investment banking space, and then now you've moved obviously to like running 20 Adventures. You founded multiple companies. So could you just give us a bit of background about yourself, your career, and then perhaps we could obviously touch a bit onto 20 Adventures as well?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. So, my background, interestingly enough, did not start in finance. You know, I didn't come from a network of people on Wall Street, which is usually how, when I started, people got involved. It actually came through my older sister's, at the time, boyfriend. I'm still friends with him to this day. He was a mentor for me. And, it was around that time that I was just kind of getting out of high school. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I had some ideas. I come from a blue collar background. So a lot of my peers were going into jobs that were more on the blue collar side. The only connection that I really had to knowing that I wanted to be on Wall Street is when I was in elementary school, no, in junior high school, there was a program that at the time was called Chemical Bank, now Chase, where I got to go into work at a bank. It was like an after school type thing. Like a field trip type thing. And I remembered how cool it was to just, go into the office and you had these people that it seemed like they were doing something, something different from, Breaking Rock or whatever. Not that there's, that I have a problem with that, but, it was just different from my world, And, my brother-in-law, he was a young broker on Wall Street. He was like, hey, why don't you come in and before you take that, I had a job lined up somewhere else. So it would have taken me totally different place. But my brother-in-law was like, hey, before you take that job, why don't you come here and see if this is something you would like? Cause I think you'd be good at it. And, that's what I did. I went to work, with him for a couple of years. And, interestingly enough, I've been, in the business ever since. I married the game, so to speak.
So like when you were saying like these like after school type thing, were you referring to like the career day where you go for like an entire day, you see like how everything works, or
something like that? It was a little bit longer, I recall. It was a couple of weeks type of program, kind of like an internship type deal. It's so long ago, I don't remember the exact specifics of it, but I remember being like, man, like I would love to do this every day, like go into the train in the city and wear a white shirt and a tie, make my dad proud. I also saw the movie Wall Street, to be honest with you, and I remember like thinking like, wow, people can do that, like this is crazy. And I have a funny story, if you don't mind me sharing it, if you have
of course.
I remember that back in like, I forget what it was like the late 80s, and at this point I had seen the movie Wall Street, I'd started reading the Wall Street Journal. I was a kid, I don't even know what the hell I was thinking, like. And thankfully my parents encouraged it. My parents are, even though they come from a blue collar background, my dad encouraged and really championed, like working in an office and getting those type of jobs. He just didn't know how to get me into that. Him, he's like, you become a real estate agent or something. That's like the easiest, not that it's easy, but the easiest barrier to entry for us would have been that. And I remember just being a kid and, I was TWA, the company TWA had declared bankruptcy at the time. The stock got crushed. And I remember my older sister, Jamie, I go to her, this is the time to buy the stock. It was like in the pennies. And I was reading the tables because that's how you had to read back in the day. You had to read the stock tables. And I tell my dad, like, hey, we got to buy this stock right now. My dad's like, get out of here. What are you talking about? And I didn't understand. And to this day, I still don't understand. I don't take no for an answer. The many times I started calling, I went to the Yellow Pages and started calling broker dealers, like brokerage firms online, like just the first ones that I could find. And I'm like, hi, how can I buy TWA stock? And they're like, are you a kid? Get off the phone. And interestingly enough, TWA actually had a turnaround, and the stock actually ended up coming back like a year or two later to like $12. Wish my dad had taken me up on that one, but that goes by way of the time I told him about Bitcoin, and he did.
Same thing happened to me. I think it was like 10. Why don't you buy some Bitcoin or something like that? And he didn't want, but I ended up finding a way to buy some. I didn't get too much, but it was still a little bit. But no, I love that. So you somewhat had this like attitude that anything you were going into, even if they would tell you no, like you would try to like make it work. Like you would be calling like the brokerage.
I mean, listen, I come from an immigrant background where my family comes from the Dominican Republic originally. My parents didn't come here with anything. For how they made it, they got a lot for them, you know. And I'm very proud of my family. And also, my dad fostered that into us of like, you know, find a way to do something. You know, there's other things that kind of like, you know, a lot of immigrants are like kind of like play it safe, go get a degree. I didn't go that route to the support of my parents at the time. But they did instill that thing in me of like, hey, don't, you know, just because somebody says you can't do it does not mean you can't do it. You know, those rules don't always apply. So, you know, I did get that from my family and also my friends. I personally, as you know, I'm a Brooklyn guy. People from Brooklyn, I think, tend to be that way. You know, it's a different vibe. You know, it's a different place.
Yeah, that's fair. And I guess like one thing I would be curious about is like obviously you mentioned that you started not in like finance like right away. You ended up going to like finance. I think you worked in like this company for like quite a while, and then you ended up starting like your own companies. I think you founded like a total of like three companies, if I'm not mistaken.
Well, no,
Four.
I started in brokerage as a broker. And what I mean by that is that you know, I got licensed in 2000, I forget, 2003, 2004, something like that. I had a small broker dealer, and you know, at that point, I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life, and I just didn't have the connections to get into venture capital. I didn't know how to do it. You know, I have no idea. So my thing was like, all this time, I'm thinking, okay, if I get into brokerage, and you know, I had different ways of getting in through friends, family, whatever, because it was like this kind of crazy thing that happened in a lot of parts of America where a lot of people in the blue collar world did get into these jobs. And you know, the tech bubble happened, and there was so much money floating around. And you know, I did help some private companies early on, but I didn't even know that was venture capital. You know, I didn't know at the time what I was doing was venture capital. And some of them survived, like not many. Most of them went bankrupt or went to zero because the bubble burst. But interestingly enough, you know, I end up going to this broker dealer, and in my mind, I thought what I do now is what I was going to do then. Instead, it was more like get on the phones, get accounts, open up investors. And not that I hated it, but I always knew that there was something kind of more for me there. And I always had an affinity to, instead of like buying a stock, which is what most brokers would do at the time, I like private companies. I like the idea of investing in them before they went public. I like the idea of investing in an IPO and capture that growth. And I did read a lot of books on investing. I had a couple of really great mentors that were phenomenal traders, you know, guys you'll never hear about, but I saw what they did trading for people. And you know, that's really kind of what shaped and molded me up until I was able to break out on my own and start 20 Ventures and another one of my companies.
And I think like one thing that you mentioned was like interesting is you mentioned like investing into like the growth of these companies before even they're like public. They might be private companies, like IPOs, et cetera. I guess like one thing I would be curious about is you somewhat took that same approach with like 20 Adventures, like being able to like support these companies through their growth, et cetera. And I guess I'd be curious like how you ended up launching like 20 Adventures and somewhat inspired you to like approach like supporting founders in a way.
Well, you know what it is my partner and I started 20 Adventures really to invest in unicorns. So we had invested through various different types of assets that are out there, and through different SPVs and broker dealers. We invested in like Patreon, we invested in Kraken. Some of these were on the cap table, some of them were not, especially the early ones, because we just didn't have the we didn't have the reputation, but we didn't know the people. So my partner did come from a background of investment banking. And my partner Nick, he did come not so much from investment banking, but he was kind of a deal maker. He had already been the CEO of a company in Asia. He had moved from Asia to Canada. He was he was trying to find what was going to be his next iteration. And I met him through the retail brokerage firm when he was bringing Chinese deals to America and consulting with them. Through that, we became very good friends and just had an affinity to this thing. And when we started 20 Ventures, we're like, hey, this is an opportunity. These unicorn companies are doing crazy. They're going crazy. Maybe we can catch lightning in a bottle. Let's, put some of these together. And then realize that they're not going public. Like these guys are just raising money at a higher valuation. And we're like, when are you going to go public, Kraken? When are you going to go public, Patreon? And we don't, we didn't swing the line or have the power to call the CEO and say, hey, do this. Nor do we want to micromanage, even if we did.
Of course.
So we came to the realization that the world that we were very good at and the world that we knew was actually that kind of nano cap, micro cap space. And when we started 20 Adventures, it was basically like, look, what we're going to do is we're going to look for really promising companies that we think can go public within a 12 to 24 month timeframe from when we write our check. We also do not invest in, like, we do not invest in any operating expenses. Our money goes into the legal, into accounting, into getting the investment bank, because we're not bankers. I'm no law industry. My partner's not. We're investors. And we do give support to the company. We give them ideas. If we think that there's a way forward or there's a potential merger that could benefit them, or while we're doing this process. And we're a lead investor, so sometimes when they're raising capital, it will make their work a little bit easier. It's just our dollars are very specific. I believe that our interests are also aligned with the investors' interest as well as the companies. And the reason that I believe in what we do, and I've told you before in the past, I like to call it public venture, is the term I'm kind of coining for this, is I think that we lost our way in the way things work now. I think companies do not go public until they're worth billions of dollars. And the little guy, the small investor, when they used to be able to buy a company at a 100, 200, $300 million market cap and ride that wave up, they no longer can do that.
So you're basically looking for these companies that want to actually like go public, not these companies that raise like $100 million, have no plans of going public or anything like
Well,
that.
there's also another dynamic too, is that this business is a business about relationships. My partners have very good relationships, and I know a couple of people here and there as well. So,
Course.
we work really good in the size space we're in. If you want to go and do a deal for, $1 billion, there's plenty of firms that will take your deal. They would love to get that commission. Our sweet spot is that, kind of nano cap, micro cap space. It's also one of the hardest because, the flip side to going public is that now you, as the CEO, you have a responsibility to the investors. You have a responsibility to the company. They're like, now you're playing a few jobs now. You're not just a CEO of the company. So we always tell our portfolio companies, like, hey, be careful what you wish for, because you got to be PR. And you know this from our own dealings. And I know that you guys some know me intimately on a couple of things. Not every CEO is really equipped to be the PR person, the front page facing guy.
Oh no.
Yeah, not
They
every.
have to be ready for that, and some are just not ready for
Yeah, and not
it.
every CEO is ready to hear, hey, you're really not the guy who should be in the front of this. Like, you're great at managing. And everybody see, not every CEO is ready to hear, hey, stop managing the company, get a good person to do that, and you be the front facing guy. That's what makes it interesting. It's the job is great because I wake up and every day there's a new challenge, and it's to me, it keeps me going.
I love that. And I guess like just going back to like the nano cap, like micro cap, like companies, As far as like just growth wise, is there like a surprising somewhat like pattern that you notice as far as like the companies that actually succeed, that actually go public, and the ones that like don't? Like I'm assuming there's not a secret sauce, but there has to be some sort of like pattern that you notice, whether it's like in the leadership team, their advantage, anything like that, or.
Yeah, I think that, well, first off, no two companies are alike. Every company is different, right?
Of course.
Well, the secret sauce is not going to be the same for everybody. Every industry is different. Honestly, a lot of times it's just catching the right trend. If you just caught the AI trend, you came out with a company a year ago and it was AI and you were public, there's not many plays, you know? We had an experience with one, a nuclear company that my partners had initially invested in. You know, they just call lightning in a bottle, you know, and the stock, it did phenomenal. You know, I won't go into numbers, but it's probably hands down one of our best investments. You know, then we have another company that is very, that like their tech is as legit as it comes. They have, you know, testing and they can't talk about a lot of their stuff because of the nature of their business. But on paper, this company kills all the other ones we have. But they don't really, they haven't figured out how to tell their story. And their management is a little bit resistant to certain things because they're a little bit old school. So there's not really necessarily a catch-all or what's going to work better. It's a couple of things. I will say, though, undoubtedly, having the right management in place, and I think this is the case for private, public, whatever, having the right management that can resonate to the public makes the difference. You know, we have actually done deals for companies like during my broker days. I look at their numbers and I'm like, wow, this company is making like $1 a share and the stock is trading at a dollar. This is insane. Like it's trading at a 30, $40 million market cap, making $50 million in revenue. Like there's a disconnect there. The problem is the management is bad at, you know, at basically giving that message out to the public and you know, which is again the PR aspect of it. Not everybody wants to do that. So,
And I guess like management wise, like sorry to cut you off, you mentioned obviously having like a good like leadership team, management team. Like how do you actually like weigh in like the founding team versus potentially like a market opportunity? Because sometimes like founders that have started like multiple companies or just starting a new one, and then you have like people that just have like really like lightning and like bottle like as you said. Is there like how do you approach like weighting in someone that has that background and someone that has like in like the bottle type opportunity?
So for us, because of the nature of the size of companies, we don't really get many guys that have started a lot of startups. Usually, if you have that kind of success, you're going to have your backers, you're going to have your people. You may not even want to go public on your next deal because it's like, why go public if you can own it? You know, and by the way, disclaimer to me, if you have a really good company, don't go public. Don't raise a dollar from anybody. Keep it to yourself. Even though that's going to cut into my business, don't go public. If your deal is that good, really, keep it to yourself, like similar to Midjourney, right? However, if you have a necessity, I think startups should really start giving a look to the possibility of can we go public to NASDAQ if we raise that first, you know, I mean, it used to be like a seed round when I started was like 500,000, 250. A seed round now is $2 million, $3 million. So it's not as simple to do that. So if you can get that and then get your company to a public market, and when I say public, I think the NASDAQ is really the one we talk about. New York Stock Exchange is great too. There's certain pedigree. It's cool. You get to go to the exchange. But NASDAQ, it's what's popping right now. It's what's moving. It's where all the tech companies want to be. So that being said, if you can, in a year's time, take your the capital that you've injected and invested and build a good enough story and build a good enough company and go public, I think that's founders are really doing themselves a disservice. Because you know what? It's a lot easier sometimes to get money from the public markets if you're hitting on all the cylinders and if you're performing. And you know, you get to keep more of your company. You don't have to, you know, because as you raise money, you keep getting diluted. There's still dilution in the public markets, but it's a little bit different because the valuations that you would be getting in the public markets when you do an overnight, when you do a deal. You know, it's a lot more beneficial, I think, to the founders. Not always. Sometimes founders, they'll get into debt spirals and all these other things. We don't ever recommend that, and we'll always push back. If our investors, the investments is going to do that because it hurts us. But you know, to me, I think that this is really the natural progression for startups is hey, don't stay private too long because you will lose the window of opportunity.
And I know we're somewhat talking about, like, I wouldn't say like challenge, but perhaps like just evaluating like your current situation and seeing like, hey, like, do we even need funding? Should we even go to like market, et cetera? Is there like any specific challenge that you feel like the people that you work with at least come to you like looking for support? I know you obviously mentioned support with like accounting, like finance, like giving them some of that like funding support,
Oh,
kind of
I can tell
them
you right
speaking,
off the
but
bat, nobody ever comes to us for support.
okay.
Everybody's looking for money.
Okay.
Always, always. We, you know, typically, again, if the company's run well, and if it's a case management team, whether first time or multiple times, they'll have all those things covered. Occasionally, we have had a couple of companies that are they're more looking for an exit, and VC doesn't really fit them. So they need work restructuring their whole model, especially
Gotcha.
these mom and pops. We have a couple of these right now, actually, that we're prepping for the next, you know, 24 months, where they're more like, hey, we actually have great earnings. We've got a lot of money on the books, but how do I leave my legacy and get new management to come in to take this over because my kids aren't going to do it, right? I can sell it to private equity, but that's going to be at some kind of a discount. And they're gonna want me to stay on for X amount of time. Versus if I take this public and you know, if it's I'm doing, you know, 50, 100 million in revenue, I could be worth X times that multiple, right? So we have seen we actually have a couple of companies, we have two companies right now that I will mention, you know, kind of stealth mode that on paper, these companies are beautiful. Management is awesome, like you know, and they're very much about like, hey. I don't want to just sell my company. I actually think this would benefit me more being a public entity and getting access to public markets and not necessarily quitting the company, but getting the next generation of people that are going to cement this legacy and my company will survive after I'm long after I'm gone. So that's pretty cool.
So some more like long term, like forward thinkers, like people that are thinking not just about selling the company, being done with it, but potentially bringing the potential or opportunity that comes with their company to the public market to potentially even grow even like further and reach that next level.
Absolutely, because it's a lot easier in the right conditions in the right market to raise equity from the stock market. You know, look, you can do if you're publicly traded, you have good value, the CEO is charismatic, he knows how to speak to the public, they're getting the right PR, you know, they're able to go talk to, and I'm not saying anything you don't know. I mean, you know, we're kind of talking to the audience here, right? You know, if you have all those things running on all cylinders, being a public entity is like a gift. You know, NASDAQ paper is as good as US dollars. So I can go raise money on an overnight for 10, $15 million. I won't owe the bank anything. I'm selling my shares. It's going to dilute me a bit, you know, but at least I don't have to be part of a, you know, a 15% loan or an 8 or 7, whatever the rates are. Like you're just getting cash that night, you know, and now you can go and do a lot. The other thing that people don't really, I think, kind of eludes them is the shares are valuable to talent. You know, you can get good management. You can go hire those people that are going to make a difference.
The people that believe in like the company that you think like long term could actually help them grow, and then if they
Yeah.
actually provide the support, then they're gonna make
Yeah, you can
more
go
money.
hire
So.
superstar management. You can hire a superstar developer. You can hire, because now instead of them getting these options that on paper are worth nothing, because really it's worth nothing. Yeah, that there's a 50 billion valuation, but until you cash that marker, it's worth nothing. Publicly traded, you give somebody shares, it's worth something.
They're intense. They're like born to actually like help you grow the company because it's going to benefit them at like the same time.
Everybody's interests are aligned, correct.
And just with like the NASDAQ, because obviously I'm in like the press space, like the first thing I'm thinking is like, okay, like if you're a publicly traded company, you're going to go like ring the bell like direct there. It's going to be like good PR. So I think that's obviously like one other thing, but that's just one of like the side benefits.
I mean, there's a lot of other benefits too that it
Of
brings.
course.
Being a NASDAQ traded company opens up a lot of doors.
Oh, yeah.
we get a lot of people that want to go and sell into enterprise. We get startups that are like, I want to sell to the enterprise. They forget about the consumer. They're not interested in consumer. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure you know in your world, a lot of people are trying to sell B2B. They don't want B2C. That's the big buzzword now is B2B. Even though ChatGPT is B2C, right? And they're the fastest growing company ever. So if you're a startup, don't knock B2C. But everybody wants to sell B2B. But guess what? When you're going into AT&T, when you're going into Verizon, their most important thing is okay, we have this company. They got a great tool. We can use this. We can even sell it for them. However, are these guys going to be around in 5 years? Are they going to be around in 10 years? What is the redundancy for this company? And, you know, having that symbol, it gives you a credibility. So to me, I think that's also important. And that's kind of like where 28 Ventures can come in, because it's not even just about, you know, helping you go public and consulting you in that ride. It's also our long-term partnerships and relationships with people we know that can get you into the door after you're publicly traded.
Yes, yeah, so you're investing in like their future in a way by giving them access, like the connections you have. And all
our shares are typically locked up, man, so we can't have the first year of the company not being unsuccessful.
Well, that's why there's a due diligence process. But just going back to like what you said, like with like the ChatGPT and stuff like that, I know that's obviously more like B2C focus. But one of the things a lot of people like don't think about is anyone consumer oriented is going to think ChatGPT. But if you are more B2B, enterprise, et cetera, you're going to be thinking OpenAI, which is like where like the real money is being made. And I think one of the questions, like I would be curious to like hear your take is perhaps where you see like the market going into like 2025, because there's so many like AI companies just spawning out of nowhere with like a new value proposition. And everyone's like, wow, like, is this going to be the next company?
Our next IPO is a company that we invested in last year in August. Mm-hmm. It was an interesting play because it was a newsletter business, and great newsletter business, but also, you know, they're kind of lagging behind. You know, there's certain things that they could have been better at. Not that the management isn't good. It's just a legacy business, but they throw off pretty good revenue. And there was something here that my partner, Nick, saw. He said, hey, we can take this company and really do something special with it. The key thing was the data. They have 20 something years of sentiment data. Our plan is actually really to integrate AI technologies into this data set, and not just that market related stuff, you know, not just financial related stuff, but also things to do with sentiment analysis for small businesses of hey, if this is happening in this place and deliveries aren't happening and logistics are messing up, how will this affect my business? Because everything matters, you know, all those little things matter. Those cracks in the wall matter. That leak could become a river, right? Yeah. So we are very, very bullish on AI. My partner and I are extremely bullish on AI. Where I see this going is, you know, I think that the chip side of things is going to be huge, as we know. You know, the processing power that's going to be needed, there's money to be made there. But the models themselves, you know, they get better, and that as hallucinations get lesser and lesser and they figure out how to do this stuff better, you know, I think there's going to be a big displacement in how we see search, you know, how business is conducted, you know, your business on the PR side of things, how that works, you know, and these things are getting a little bit more human, so to speak. It's not true. Like, to me, it's kind of comical when people think this is like artificial. It's not. It's really just a bunch of agents that are performing tasks that gives you the concept, the idea that this is a human, right? Yeah. As they get better, you know, certain
industries. It'll be harder to tell.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm bullish on AI, man. I'm bullish on AI. I'm bullish on the chip side of things. I'm bullish on the energy side of this stuff, because this stuff has massive power that it will need to be, which Nano Nuclear, one of our companies, so. Shout out to Nano. Hopefully they can, you know, they can do something with that and actually make a reactor.
Because I think it's really about making, I mean, at least if you're looking at like companies like invest in, et cetera, you have to make that differentiation between the ones that are in for the long run and are not just using some like wrapper to create like random software and just like call it a day. Because I've seen like so many of them. They're going to stay for a few months. They're going to move to the next thing.
Well, there's a couple of pure plays when it comes. I mean, market's concerned, there's not really many AI publicly traded companies. Most of them are
Oh,
opting,
no.
yeah, they're opting to stay private, you know, and raise that valuation. But mo you're right in that a lot of these are wrappers, they're ChatGPT or OpenAI wrappers around whatever thing they want to do, whether it's trading or whatever, I don't know. But yes, those guys, look, they're going to make money. And in a sense, it's better for them to do it that way, because why are they going to invest billions into the AI models? You know, if it's there. And some of those companies are going to be around, or or not ChatGPT, but OpenAI, Perplexity, all these guys will buy, end up buying those guys, which is for us, again, why our the business that we just got into that's going to be going public. That's why it was important for us, because we saw the value of the customers. You know, they have a good amount of paid subscribers, they have a good amount of free subscribers. So we're like, okay, wow, we can pen test some of these ideas that we want to do with the technology we're going to acquire in the coming months. That's who really is always going to win out too, man. It's who, like, as much as enterprise matters, it all trickles down to the customers. You know, the biggest companies in the world right now are really highly qualified forums of customers, where you know where the customers are buying, what they're doing.
They're customer centric, just like Amazon, like
Yeah.
specifically focused on the
Super
customer.
centric, man. That's the dollar everybody wants. Yeah.
That makes sense. Cool. And I guess perhaps just for like some parting thoughts here, any specific advice that you would have for, I guess it could be someone just in like the VC space, or it could honestly be just a founder trying to like grow their company. They're looking for funding, but they're just not sure how to get to like that next stage of like their growth. If that makes sense.
I mean, I think that I don't like to give advice anymore, because I think that everybody's, it's all different. I've seen, like, what works for one doesn't necessarily work for another. So it's pompous of me to think that my way of doing things is right, because honestly, it's not. It may just be right for me. But
That's
I would
fair.
say that the biggest thing that I would tell the companies that are in need of capital, which is always the case, is two things. Number one, you got to always be raising capital. Even if you're a public company, you have to be thinking about, until you're fully solvent, where your profits are so great that you don't need money, you got to be thinking about, what when am I going to raise the next deal? Also, I would say that you have to listen to the people around you. You know, don't fall into the echo chamber of, well, you know, I did this, this is great, and I did it myself. You have to be coachable. You have to be willing to listen to the people that came with you and have helped you build. If you did it by yourself, God bless, you know, but there's not many of those stories. So you have to be willing to listen to the people around you, because probably they may know pain points that you're not looking at. So that's the only advice that I would give to founders. For VC, I have nothing to say. I mean, everybody's, you know, good
That's
luck,
fair.
I would say. That's,
Good
you know.
luck. You're gonna get crushed in the next few years.
No, I don't believe that. I think that venture capital, the markets, you know, look, I'm a capitalist, man. Everybody wants to rag on Wall Street. A lot of things would not happen without Wall Street. And I'm not saying that there's not bad guys and opportunists. Again, as capitalists, opportunists, that's kind of the definition of a lot of what we're doing. We're trying to find that spot, right? So I would say that I think VCs are always going to be here. It'll be different. The money may come from different places, but I think that the next couple of years is still going to be great for venture capital. It's going to be great for private equity. If you have money, it's always going to be good for you, if you have the money to buy into something.
Yeah, that's fair. Great. Well, really appreciate you being on the show, Frank. If there's like anyone that wants to get in like touch with you, is there like any platform you're most active on, anywhere that they should be looking at the where?
A lot of people are getting in touch with me. I'm good right now. Thank you so much. I would say probably don't get in touch with me, because so many people, like, they bombard me on LinkedIn, man. Especially after the movie and a couple of articles on some of our investments came out. No, actually, you can go to the website if you're interested. If you have something that you think is interesting and would pique my interest. I'm pretty agnostic when it comes to our investment side of things.
Course.
It's just, what we do is not for everybody. I would just let everybody know that, although I think going public faster is the best case scenario for all companies that are at the startup stage, you know, it may not be for you. So if you're, again, like a mid-journey, why go public? Just stay private, keep getting that cash, and just keep stacking. The thing for companies that are looking for capital, though, is, if you have something you think is compelling, something interesting, we look at all deals, man. I've had people try to pitch me like bubble tea startups, all kinds of stuff. So
Oh, I
we
love
look at
it.
everything, man.
Perfect. Well, appreciate your time, Frank.